Okay, got that. So once more, just letting everything go, everything until you were standing here, anything before that, just let it go. You're going to listen to teachings that have been around for 2,500 years. So beneficial. So we show respect. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. Thank you. Thank you. So again, it's the prayer book, page 73. And again, as we do the prayers, maybe, you know, just give yourself a mental note every time you touch upon something that we have discussed in the Lam Rim. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. When, O Supreme amongst humans, you were born on this earth, you paced out 7 strides, then said, I am supreme in this world. To you who were wise then, I prostrate. With pure bodies, formed supremely pure, wisdom ocean like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the three worlds, winner of the best, Lord, to you I prostrate. With the supreme signs, face like spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Dust free like you, the three worlds are not. Incomparably wise one, to you I prostrate. The Saviour having great compassion, the founder having all understanding, the field of merit with qualities like a vast ocean, to you, the one gone to thusness, I prostrate. The purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from the lower realms, the one path, the sublime pure reality, to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and who also show the path to liberation, the holy few qualified with realizations, who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you, the sublime community intending virtue, I prostrate. Homage to the Supreme Buddha, homage to the Dharma refuge, homage to the great Sangha, to all three, ever devout homage. To all worthy of respect, bowing with bodies as many as all realms, atoms in all aspects, with supreme faith I pay homage. Do not commit any non-virtuous actions. Perform only perfect virtuous actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. A star, a mirage, a flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew or a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, a cloud. See conditioned things as such. Through these merits, may sentient beings attain the rank of all seeing. Subdue the four faults and be delivered from samsara's ocean, perturbed by the waves of aging, sickness, and death. Thank you. So I'm hoping you're all well and that you had a nice session last night. Remembering, if there's any questions about any of this personal study you do when you're working together as a group, just make a note of whatever questions arise, and hopefully Saturday morning we can look at it and see how far we can get in answering those particular questions. So although you're doing this work on your own, which I think is often more valuable than a teacher, but that's just me, if there's anything that comes up, we can discuss that. No worries. So let me just put this a wee bit closer. So as you're settling yourself down for meditation, please, I ask you to consider a situation where you're dying. It's not a quick death, it's not a slow death, it's just progressive. They ask you to think of it, where you would be, perhaps at home, perhaps in a hospital, perhaps somewhere else. I ask you to imagine an environment around you. I ask you to imagine who you think might or could be there. So begin by just settling the body in a good position, reasonable, back reasonably straight, head in a good position, tall at the back, tall, and the chin ever so slightly down. Arms comfortable at your side. Abandoning everything external to you at the moment. Bring the mind inward. Paying attention to how your whole body responds to each in-breath and out-breath. each in-breath and out-breath. Allow one part of your mind to gently scan the body, simply noting any areas of tension. And when you notice them, simply release on a natural out-breath. Notice the result of this relaxation. The smoothness of the forehead. The spaciousness around the eyes and between the eyes. The relaxation of all the facial muscles. The downward tilt of your shoulders as it releases tension. And work your way through the rest of the body. To stabilize your meditation, focus now on the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. Keeping still as possible, without any tension. Notice your state of relaxation, maintain it, and shift your focus to the in-breath. Simply notice, without any effort, that with each in-breath, the mind is becoming sharper, clearer, bright. Generating a strong positive motivation for today, especially for the next meditation, which is the death process. Try to generate a strong positive motivation for that, and then focus on that motivation. When meditating on the death process, we need to bring to mind whatever knowledge we have about the four elements of the body: earth, water, fire, and air. This is part of our body makeup. and whatever knowledge we have about the five aggregates. These are simply how the body and mind are composed. So the aggregate of form, this body, everything solid about it. The aggregate of feeling. The aggregate of discrimination. The aggregate of compensational factors in consciousness. If you have no knowledge, this is no problem. It's just a way of breaking down and looking at the body and mind and its component parts. Because as death progresses, all of these sequentially deteriorate and lose power. All absorb one into another. And as this happens, the dying individual has a certain bodily response, which they will notice. And they also have a mental picture, a kind of vision, which will come to their mind. As I said yesterday, there are many levels of this meditation based on the depth and range of study. So please, right now, settle yourself mentally in the dying position that you've been thinking about. Really people your mind with who's going to be around, where you are, what's in the room. When we participate in a death meditation, we understand that death can be confusing. And so it's quite important to understand the process, become familiar with it. It's just physical deterioration and mental projections. So you are dying now. You know it. Everyone else in the room knows it. And if you're unlucky enough, people are not really acknowledging that fact. But you know. You begin to feel the beginning of that death process. That form aggregate, your body, everything dense about it, is beginning to deteriorate it. You can feel it. This form feeling, this aggregate, can no longer sustain the consciousness that had supported it in life. You're feeling quite heavy, as if you're being, well, just under some sort of weight. This is very normal. You notice that you have very little strength in any of your limbs. They feel quite thin, somehow loose. You have an overall sense of sinking. You can't open or close your eyes anymore. If your eyes were open at the beginning of this process, they remain open. You can't close them. If they were closed, you can't open. Those in the room, when they see you, there seems to be a lack of vitality. There is a spark about a living being, which is absent in a dying and dead living being. So the vitality seems to go. The luster that we all have diminishes. If your eyes are open, color begins to fade. If your eyes are open, your sight is quite dark, quite unclear. You have an internal vision now appearing to your mind. It's like a mirage, a silver, blue, hazy mirage. And you can apprehend this quite clearly now. This is the final sign that the form aggregate, the power is lost now and is absorbed into the next aggregate. Now the second stage is your feeling aggregate. The power begins to reduce. And it reduces so much that this aggregate of feeling can't sustain its consciousness. You do not now experience pleasure, pain, or indifference. Prior to this, you could hear people talking in the room, but now you can't hear anything. In our life, even with the external silence, there's always been a kind of internal humming in the ear. But now even that is gone. You've never experienced a silence like this. Your body now is totally inert. Your mouth, tongue, throat, very dry. No saliva now. And all the fluids are drying up. Those in the room will notice this, and in particular, they'll notice a very fast forming scum on the teeth. If you've ever been with a dying person, you will notice a kind of scum on the teeth. and the feeling aggregate has totally absorbed into the water element now. Your internal vision changes. Presenting to your mind now is a vision of puffs of smoke. Thin puffs of smoke billowing up as if from a bonfire. Next, the discrimination aggregate begins to lose its power and can no longer sustain its consciousness. You will know this because now you can't even smell anything. Before there was a smell in the room, now you can't smell anything. There is no way you can pay attention to anything in the room or anyone. Your mind doesn't go there. And as for names, even if the people in the room are your closest family, you can't remember names. That's gone. Those in the room will notice that your breathing has changed. Your inhalations are quite short. Your exhalations are quite long. People will notice a rattling, gasping sound coming from you. Your internal vision changes. You now see in your mind like sparks of fire, sometimes described like fireflies. Just sparks of flies, but sparks of fire everywhere, like from a bonfire. Next, your compositional factors begin to deteriorate and can no longer support consciousness. Now you can't move your tongue even. There's no sense of taste. And you can't experience touch. Even if those in the room are trying to get your attention, you can't experience that. Your mouth will probably stay open. And those in the room will notice that the tongue seems to have shrunk and has a kind of bluish tint to it. And they will notice that you are no longer breathing. And we know when people no longer breathe, they're labeled dead, but still, within you there is a subtle breath. And you now have a mental vision of a candle flame. Like a candle flame, a light. It's kind of like a dim red blue light. And this flame is flickering, 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 and then steady. And now you know the five sense minds, which were always temporary, they are no more. And the gross mental consciousness, luminous and knowing, this nature of the mind emerges. And this mind also has gross levels, subtle and very subtle levels. The majority of your concepts now, fear, anger, jealousy, joy, they're all absorbed now, disappearing, and allowing the more subtle levels of mind to manifest. Remember, everyone in the room thinks you're dead, but you have a vision to mind now. And this vision is called the mind of white appearance. To your mind, there is a kind of luminosity appears, open, unobstructed, described as like an autumn sky suffused by white light and nothing else. And as the mind becomes more subtle, the subtle mind of red increase appears. This mind, this vision, gives you a kind of vivid red-orange appearance. And nothing else. And this mind of red increase dissolves into the mind of black near attainment. And your vision is that of darkness, black. And then there's a kind of unconsciousness happens, and you're aware of nothing. Soon, a vivid black appearance comes to mind. The mind of black near attainment. And this mind of black near attainment becomes more and more subtle. Unconsciousness clears. And the mind of clear light manifests. This is the final death vision. A very clear, light sky, like that of an autumn dawn, completely empty. This is the fundamental, innate mind of clear light. It's possible that those in the room may see a trickle of red substance coming from the nose. If they check, they may see a trickle of white fluid from the sex organ. Not always, but it does happen. For many of us, due to our illness and disease, this may not happen. And it is this fundamental nature, this most subtle mind, that leaves the body. Even this subtle mind retains the habit of being attached to a self. And so it is said there is a kind of fear arises of I am becoming non-existent. And this innate craving for a body arises. And you develop what's called a bardo body, this intermediate state. And as you're born into the bardo, the processes of the eight stages that we've just gone through occur in reverse order. Clear light. Vivid black near attainment. Red increase. The white appearance. A steady, then flickering flame. Sparks of fire. Puffs of billowing smoke. A mirage. And suddenly, you have a bardo body. Many teachings about that. It's often said that if you look at your body now, it shows you what your future body will be like. If you're going to be born human, it is said that it appears like a 5 or 6 year old. And it's like a dream body. It's quite indestructible. It is said this body has many psychic powers for a while. It is said that eventually, this craving for a new body drives the bardo being to find a new body. Some of the texts talk about the bardo being seeing their parents making love. And they enter the crown of the father, travel down the central psychic channel. And then when the father ejaculates into the mother, your consciousness goes with it. And you develop in the womb exactly as scientists and doctors say. You grow, you develop, and it comes the time of birth. And as you're being reborn, think, what type of rebirth will I have? It will depend on your karma. What type of rebirth would you like? You can create the causes now. And so birth, death, sickness, all arises again. What drives this? Delusion and karma drives it. Can it be stopped? Yes. When you finish this meditation by realizing you're doing this meditation simply to become familiar with what could happen. If your death were quick, then all of that happens, but in the snap of a finger. If you're lucky to die more slowly, you can follow this process. Why bother? Because it's very useful to know that you're dying. It's extremely useful to know you're dead. And it's useful to know you're in the bardo. Anything that appears to mind is projections of your mind. It is said that sometimes the projections can be quite terrible in the bardo. Sometimes the projections in the bardo can be very beautiful. But they're only your karma ripening, nothing to get attached to, nothing to have fear of. It's the greatest gift you could have. Thank you. So if you like to make, maybe jot down a note or two of anything that occurred to you during that. Perhaps make a note, is this something you would like to do again and again? Do you see a value in it? Or as some students have said to me, I will never do that again, ever, Mary. Thank you. I've had that said. How do you feel about doing this type of thing? Is it valuable to you? Does it open up more questions? If so, those questions are valuable. All of it. And so if you're happy to do so, it might be beneficial to share with each other your experiences within that death process. I would say only 15 minutes. But if you'd rather sit quietly with it, then that's fine. But it can be helpful to share. So if you're happy to do 15 minutes in a group, sharing your experience, please do so. Good. I hope the discussion was good. If you spent time just considering, I hope that was fruitful. Is there anything you want to question, comment about that? Oh, okay. Okay, Gabriel. I'm not hearing you. I'm not hearing. Thank you.
Can you hear me now?
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, for me, the value of that meditation kind of depends on whether I fully believe in the kind of life after life reincarnation, and I still don't know. That's something I'm like kind of thinking a lot about. If that is, you know, if that is a real thing, then that meditation I can fully see the value in, and it's like it's something that I would want to do a lot more of. And it even makes sense to do it just in case, you know. Because I'm assuming there's no version of death where that knowledge wouldn't be useful.
Yeah.
It's always wise, Gabriel, to hedge your bets.
I do confession every Sunday as well, just in case.
The more information that you can put in the pot, the more things that you can actually observe and check out. I would say when it comes to reincarnation, it's very interesting. I remember when I first heard about it, I thought, what a load of nonsense. I mean, it was hard not being brought up Catholic, you know what I mean? I mean, personally. But then I thought about it and I thought, well, even when I was brought up Catholic, there was different realms of existence, which I had just accepted because I'd been told. You know, I mean, they don't push it now, but in fact, they don't push a lot of this now, but heaven, hell, purgatory, limbo, all that was places you went to. The difference was there was just one journey and that was it. You made it or you didn't make it, that type of thing. But even then, I thought, well, maybe it's worth considering. I think if you study the Dharma, and many things will point you in that direction, but for me, the thing that really changed my mind was mind. Understanding the nature and the function of mind. That first handout I gave you, the very first handout, where it talks about nature and function, where it talks about continuity of mind, meditations around that. It's not trying to program you. What it's trying to do is actually ask you to investigate that which we wouldn't normally even look at.
The thing is, for me, I totally believe in beginningless mind, that I'm totally
fine. Okay, okay.
It just, for me, it doesn't necessarily follow from that, that we would have one life following another in that kind of...
I understand.
Yeah. Way. It's not that I think that it's that it's unlikely. It's just that it's not a logical progression for me, if that makes sense.
That's okay, and it needs study.
Yeah.
Because none of this is to be believed, really, none of it. It really has to be experienced. But the question I would suggest you ask yourself, if you believe in beginningless lives, you know, mind going back from the beginning, when you talk about beginningless mind, do you also mean beginningless life?
So for me, the way that I have seen it is that there is essentially one mind, and that when a sentient being comes into existence, they become like a wellspring for that mind. So it appears as though that is one individual mind. I don't know if that makes any sense. So that it's like the question of where does my mind go when I die is like asking where does the water go when a well runs dry. It's not one unit of water. It's just water back in.
If you're interested, then further study around the mind is important. I would say be careful of generalizations, be careful of analogies, particularly be careful of similes.
Okay.
They are useful only to point you in a direction. But what happens sometimes, especially with similes, is that we tend to grasp onto the simile and leave it there. And then we're happy with this kind of broad, slightly nebulous thing that's going to happen. Or not happen. Like that. These are useful only if they point yourself in the direction of some sort of knowledge. There is knowledge out there to be had. But whether you take it on board or believe it, that is, of course, totally. But what you're trying to do is make an informed decision. And if you're making an informed decision, you don't stop thinking. And Buddha Dharma, you don't stop meditating. Because when you get a personal experience of it, it will change everything. What you're saying is not unusual, and it is very reasonable. Very reasonable.
Yeah, that's it. And if the reincarnation thing is true, then obviously I want to believe it, so I want to get, I want to get to the truth. So is there anything in particular, any particular reading that you would suggest?
We'll talk about that on Saturday. Okay. Thank you. We'll talk about that on Saturday. Thank you very much. Nina?
My question was just the meditation that you shared, is that part of Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim teachings, or is that somewhere else as well?
Good question. Where do these teachings come from? These teachings really come from Tantra. They're actually derived from Tantric teachings. They are derived from yogis who have spent their whole life meditating and doing particular tantric meditations, which take them through death to the clear light. But they then have they've developed the qualities of mind that can bring them back from the clear light. Like that. They come from yogis who can experience past lives. And it's really quite interesting. Yogis from Tibet, all over different types of Tibet, all over India, Southeast Asia, it's quite interesting that a lot of what they reflect back on, there is a cultural overtone, but the main points seem to be very similar, very, very similar. Will you find them in Lama Tsongkhapa's teaching? Yes, you'll find them in the Great Exposition. When they're talking about death and karma, but it didn't come from Lama Tsongkhapa. Okay, it came from tantric teachings. Anyone else? Questions? Comments? Yes.
I found this very useful and very. Touching and meaningful. I think I remember reading that in the bardo stage where this urge to find another body becomes very, very pronounced, that it's very, very important just to stay very, very calm and not to kind of follow any kind of instinctive urges. Might you be able to say a word or two on that?
Well, if you have practiced, have you ever experienced a lucid dream? That's a no. Okay, let's look at it like this. You need to have experienced and to have worked through this clinging, attachment, aversion, this ignorance in your life. To be able to put that into some form of use to you in the bardo. If you arrive in the bardo, and it's not a quick death, many deaths are very quick, so you go through all this very quickly. But if your death takes a bit of time and you end up in the bardo, what they say is the predominant feeling here is fear. It's fear. Where is my body? Where am I? Why are these people ignoring me? Yes? Like all this, fear. If you can remember you're dead, that would be very helpful. If you know you're dead, then that's very helpful. If you know you're dead and you've practiced Dharma, then especially in relation to mind, especially in relation to ignorance, attachment, aversion, you have a strong chance of remaining calm, despite whatever appears to you. Now, if you read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, all about the bardo, some of the visions could be very, very frightening. I am not sure how much of that is culturally driven. I have to tell you, I am not sure. But what I am sure of is that attachment and aversion, if that stays with me and I don't know that I'm dead, fear will arise. And if fear arises, I'll run away from this and I'll crave that. And delusion and karma will drive me towards craving rebirth. And if I'm lucky, it'll be a human rebirth. If I'm not, other karma will ripen. It'll be a different type of rebirth. But if you can arrive in the bardo and you kind of know you're dead, I can't tell you how important that would be. That would be so good. If you superimpose that some understanding of ignorance, attachment, and aversion, whatever appears to you, you remain calm. You don't allow attachment to take hold. You don't allow fear or aversion to take hold. Then you've got a strong chance of a much better rebirth. Because unless you're very well realized, you'll still be driven by delusion and karma, but it'll be quite light. It will be quite light. Now, according to some books, some teachings on the bardo, there are various visions. And there's a whole load of teachings about how you behave with this vision and how you behave with that vision. I have not had teachings on it. It's not heavily emphasized. I have not noticed it being heavily emphasized in Galupa, these various visions and how to deal with it. I have seen it very heavily emphasized in Kagyu and Nyingma. I have seen that. What I've, in my learning and in people who have taught me have said, what you really need to do is be aware you're dead. Work on your ignorance, attachment, and aversion and bring that with you into the bardo. Then you've got a chance of remaining calm. Great beings who have progressed long on the path can not only remain calm, but can choose their rebirth. Originally, that's what Rinpoche meant. Originally, there's a lot of different people being called Rinpoches now for various reasons, but originally Rinpoches really donated someone who chose their own rebirth in order to benefit sentient beings. If you've ever lucid dreams, here's the thing that I've learned. Unless you're really good at lucid dreaming, really good, and that means you've really kind of worked at it, your ability to direct your dream is not as easy as it is to direct your own life. We can direct our life. In a dream, you can direct it, but it's more difficult. It's more difficult, unless you've worked at it. And that's a subtle mind. A bardo mind is even subtler. So I'm thinking that unless you've worked at it, it would be really quite difficult to direct that mind. Because you're blown here and there. This is what the text said. You're blown about by the karmic winds. Blown about by the karmic winds. So what my teacher said to me very early on, and I'm very glad they said it, because I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it just went completely over my head. And it wasn't a thing I really wanted to spend my time on, but it does appeal to a lot of people. What appeals to me is working in this life, making it better, trying to keep that awareness, ignorance, attachment, aversion, this kind of understanding of the nature of reality, making lots of prayers, making lots of effort that if I arrive in the bardo, it's not a quick death, that I know that I'm dead. If I am strong enough to know that I'm dead, I should be strong enough to remember a bit of the Dharma. If I'm going to remember even a little bit of the Dharma, then I want to remember about craving and aversion, and that what is appearing to me is only appearance of mind. If you want more teachings on Bardo, then you need to, you know, look further afield. I don't go into it any further than that. It is very interesting. But I kind of know what, you know. And certainly for this type of course, you don't go into it in any depth. If you do, you'd have to look out for teachings Bardo teachings. But I know people who are extremely interested in that. I'm more interested in this life, preparing for the next life, and knowing that I'm dead. That would be very useful to me. Is that okay?
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Anyone else? Maybe.
For Merit, I was wondering how you help somebody who's dying. So that's kind of part A. And part B is the Buddhist community in the UK is not humongous. So how can we get help for people who are dying who are Buddhist? And how can we plan for our own death?
Well, this is huge. I mean, this is huge, Mary, you know. And as I said to you right at the very beginning, there's different ways of approaching teachings on death. One of them is the way I'm approaching it now. You need to know that. The next step would be teaching how to own your own death. Right? That's the next step. No use trying to help other people if you can't help yourself. And if you know how to help yourself, you will know how to help others. And so this teaching I'm doing in Liverpool starting next month, just, you know, one evening a week, that's going to be owning your own death. Once you get that, then teachings on how to help others, you're going to bring to that teaching understanding of death, understanding the death process, what you need to help yourself. Now let's put all that together to help others. That's how it works. I've done a week on karma, a week on death, and we've got to the stage of how to help yourself. Without this, then it's just not informed. It's not informed. So it's like that. And how the community in the UK can do it, well, I've been teaching for many years, and every time I teach this, and especially owning your own death, there's usually a group of people that go, oh, we've got to do something about this. And we get a community sorted out. We get cards printed. Please contact me, this person at the time of death who can help me, blah, blah, blah. And it lasts for a little while, and then it just fades away. There is nobody out there going to do this unless we get together as a community. A group of strong-minded people, doesn't have to be many, but who are willing, who are in this until it's sorted, what will happen? I've seen this begin many times. And then this person drops out, and then this person, until there is nobody. So I think it needs a group. I think it needs a dedicated group. I know at Land of Joy, they're beginning to look at this, well, quite seriously. And to work out a strategy. It needs to have a strategy. Buddhists are not very good at, we're not very good at this. I don't know why, but for 40 years, I get people going very airy-fairy on me. Oh, well, you know, they drift off here and they drift off here. Oh, forget that nonsense. We have skills. We are very good in this country, and all through Europe, we are very good at planning, implementing, evaluating. But somehow we don't bring it into Dharma. We need to value these skills that we already have and get it sorted. This is not difficult. In Holland, a friend of mine got together with her group, and there was one or two people who were particularly interested. And not only did they have it, most of it sorted, they've actually given discussions. They've actually had teachings with the funeral people in that area about death and how Buddhists want to die. They've taught them, they've had study days for these directors, they've given them contact details. Not contact details of someone that will just drift off in the future. Solid, reliable. And so when someone dies and they have this Buddhist information, then the funeral directors now know who to contact. They now know how to deal with the body and the relatives. Who's going to do it? And we have the skills. It's just sometimes with Dharma, we're often told, oh, you're just foolish Westerners. I've heard that before. You really don't know better. You have so many skills that people, that some of our Tibetan colleagues don't have. And we should value it and use it. Is that okay? I know you wanted answers. Nah. I'm a trained teacher. We don't give straightforward answers if we can avoid it. Yes, Ina.
Hi, Mary. I'm sorry if I've already asked this yesterday, but the question that keeps coming into my mind is, what's the point in practicing this if the death process is empty of inherent existence? Why would I spend time doing this?
Okay, so this lack of inherent existence, yes, is the ultimate reality. But you don't live the ultimate reality. You live the conventional reality. Is conventional reality a truth? Yes, it is. Is it the ultimate truth? No. How we enact in this world is on a conventional level. And so if it's not important to learn the death process, then it's not important to learn any sort of Dharma. It's not important to learn any religion. It's not important to learn how to drive. Ultimately, there is no car. Ultimately, why bother eating? You see, it's not how we don't live ultimately. What ultimate is to realize it. First of all, on an intellectual level, and then on an experiential level. But until that happens, we live conventionally. So, of course, everything we do, everything we learn is highly important to us, highly important. Remember, we're not saying these things don't exist. They just don't exist the way we think they do.
I guess what I'm saying is, so thank you for sharing that, because what you're saying is important. We have to have that understanding of conventional reality, so I acknowledge that. But in terms of preparing for the time of death, would it not be more beneficial to meditate on the emptiness of that process? Because then when death happens, you train yourself to know that actually whatever it is you're seeing, whatever's happening,
is empty. I understand. This, what we're talking about, what we've just done, is a training process. What you're talking about, training yourself to see the reality of it, the whole of the Dharma is about that. Really, that is the whole of the wisdom ring. Right? If you can do this, nothing else matters. If you do this, you're enlightened. But if you think, you may be at the stage, I don't know, but if you think you can train for this, and then the training is enough, then that's incorrect. It will take long enough to train for this to develop an intellectual understanding. Then that intellectual understanding has got to be transformed into your bones, into your bones. And then you have to what's called realize it. In order to realize it, to make any difference, for this process, it means that you have to develop shamatha. You need to have a meditation practice that is so strong that you can penetrate the nature of reality. You have to learn to be able to do that in meditation and then transform that when you're out of meditation, and that will take a while. It's not about training. Training is about it. When it comes to reality, when it comes to this, all of the other stuff that we talk about, that's all method. There's only one thing on this wing of wisdom, and that's the nature of life's emptiness. Yes, we need to train and study and take an intellectual understanding and then turn it into real experience so we know it in the bone. Would that be useful to you at the time of death? Absolutely, absolutely. That would be it. No problem. I don't think that emptiness is the same, requires the same level of understanding of karma, of the death process, of precious human rebirth, of bodhicitta. It requires more than that. All of these things are only methodologies, and it has one purpose: focus you and to take you towards this one aspect of wisdom, the only aspect of wisdom, nature reality. So if we were a high yogi living in the mountains with nothing else to worry about, and you're doing meditation or a yogic level day after day, are you going to worry about the death process? No, because you're already using it. So your efforts will be making sure that in the bone, what you understand in the bone, you work with nature of reality. Good day. Would it were any simpler? I'll tell you something, though. What keeps me going is really, in the end, it's what Lama Zopa says. It's about living a life that is happier for you, based on reality, being able to benefit others. Really, there's no other reason that you're here. So I kind of see that as my basis. That's really all I'm here for. I'm developing as I go, I hope. But again, I know I've said it a few times, again, maybe a bit clearer when we get to the session on emptiness, hopefully. But if you're struggling with this, I wouldn't worry about it. You should be struggling with it. Everybody that even considers this ought to be struggling with it. If this were easy, we'd all be enlightened, no problem. It's not. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, Mario?
Well, I just would like to do some comments on this last day's discussions. I'm trying to see this from a different lens, because I think everything that we have been discussing lately are cultural issue in our Western society. I have been brought in Christianity or in the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church has been so strong throughout the centuries that they have set boundaries. The problem is that those boundaries are not only according to the Church, are boundaries. They try to limit your own mind, your own beliefs. And then when you come to here and listen to you and read about and learn more about Buddhism, we find out that somehow we have been cheated for a long time. Sorry to use this word.
I understand, Mario, really. I understand. But I'm sorry to cut you short, but the thing about this is, whatever our cultural background, whether it's theist, Christian, Hindu, whatever, or whether it's non-theist, we all come with that kind of baggage, right? For me, I was brought up Catholic, and I mean, to a certain extent, I loved it all. I loved all the bells and whistles. Great fun, no problem. I was taught by monks and priests. It wasn't, even when I decided it wasn't for me, it wasn't that I disliked it. I mean, the truth is, it interfered with me having a nice time, basically. And of course, I then began to realize that having a nice time to me was far more important than anybody else said. And when I met the Dharma, I think it was the first time that I started to ask questions. all the way through. And this is true for many people of lots of, it's not just Catholicism, all the different things. It's a set of dogmas which you're asked to believe. Now, within those set of dogmas, there are very good people, very good ways of practicing, where there's a lot of questions and answers. I understand that. Certainly in my case, the teachers I had were monks and priests. They didn't just give you answers. They told you what questions to ask. They had it sewn up. So you learnt the questions and you learnt the answers. You didn't have to think. What I valued about Dharma was it helped me think. But you could say that, people, depending how they're brought up, they could say that about Catholicism. They could say that about any form. Even atheists, I've had atheists say to me, doesn't matter what the religion is, I never learned to think until I became an atheist. The important thing is that you learn to think for yourself. In Buddha Dharma, and to be honest, also in atheism, you learn to think for yourself. This cultural baggage can be heavy. Can be heavy. Whatever it is. I mean, I'm remembering a particular fundamental Christian. I don't know why they came on the course, but they did. And I mean, this person had everything except a tambourine. Very difficult. Very difficult. But they obviously were searching for something. We all have it. I think what we have to have is whatever's been going around culturally. If it's not for you, many people are very happy being a theist of whatever shape form, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if it's not for you, then develop the right questions. Develop confidence in your ability to find out what's true. I think that's important. What do you think, Mario?
Well, I really enjoy the Buddhism philosophy because there is always answers to all the questions. And I had the opportunity when I need to talk with Catholic priests, for instance, and asking them for help, and they, okay, just 10 Ave Marias, 20, you know, this kind of stuff. And in Buddhism, so the first time I set foot here in Land of Joy, changed completely my mindset, completely, 100%. And I'm very pleased to be here again and listen to you, and especially on these matters of happiness and also death. I feel much, I can share with all of you that I feel much more confident, if I can use this word. About death than before. I had a weekend, I believe, with you about death. That changed me. I was afraid of going to the cemetery. I was afraid of, you know, I felt a fear. I was not really comfortable. And now when I go to the cemetery, I speak to my parents like they were just like next to myself. And I feel very, very light. And that's thanks to you, thanks to
that's good. That's good because it's a personal experience. In Buddha Dharma, you don't, excuse me a second, I have a magic door. One of the promises you make when you become a Buddhist is you do not put down any other religion. You just don't do it. It's very, very important you don't do that. Because religion, certain religions for certain people are very, very valuable, and they're comfortable, have a calm mind with it. You don't want to disturb anybody's mind. And so whatever religion they are, if you're a Buddhist, you never put that down. You never say Catholics are like this and born again Christians, not like that. What you can say is it's not for me. It's not for me. And you make a choice. You have to be careful. You have to be careful in Dharma because it's a big negativity to put things down. I can share experiences with you, but what I'm really saying, I'm not saying this is bad. I'm saying this is how I felt when it happened. It obviously wasn't for me. So we have to kind of keep that in mind. It's very important. Very important. Lama. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is often within multi-faith situations and people saying things that are diametrically opposed to Dharma. He never criticizes. He always looks for the similarities within it all. But for individual progress, you decide what's good for you. You decide what's good for you.
So probably Buddhism is the only, say, religion or the only philosophy that is not, I don't know if this is the word, correct word, proselytist.
Oh yes, proselytizing, yes.
Yeah,
yes, if anyone knocks on your door and says, have you heard the good news about Buddhism? Just close the door.
Yeah, that's the one. The others are...
I tell you how this is. If you want Buddhist teaching originally, you would have to request three times to a teacher, three times. And I'm talking about, this was before my, I've been a Buddhist for 43 years. So it'd be before that, right? But really in recent years, you'd have to request three times. And when I say request, I'm talking on bended knees, hands together, with many, many gifts, many, many gifts, to show that you meant what you were saying. In Tibet, like that. You had your village lama, basically he was there to give a little bit of teaching and, you know, deal with death, really, the death processes. But otherwise, if you wanted it, you had to really show that you wanted it. Now, when I first started, Westerners, we used to discuss, do you think it's right that we advertise? It was so ingrained in us 40 odd years ago that I was part of discussions that, well, I don't know, if we advertise, is that like trying pushing it down people's throats? It's come a long way, right? So now we advertise in social media, we put posters up, but it wasn't always like that. I remember the first couple of times I went to see a teacher in the original London place, at someone's house, and you had to ask permission to sit in that class. And the teacher would say, do you really want to know? They were so careful. Now we advertise everywhere. But still, you don't push it. You don't push it. If people don't want to come, that's fine. Because if you do tend to push it, you have no clairvoyance. The great Shanti Davis said, if you really want to help someone, develop clairvoyance. As he said, it's the only pure way to help someone. Because what someone says they want is not often what they do. We know that. So to disturb someone's mind by saying, have you heard the good news about Buddha? This is not good. You don't know what that mind is like. You don't know if that mind is ready. You don't know if what you say sounds very good, but could cause a lot of disturbance. If someone says to you, tell me all about Buddhism, here's a tip. I'm glad you're interested. That's your first thing. Go away and think about it. Come back with specific questions. 9 times out of 10, they don't come back because they're not really interested. Okay? They want to be entertained. If they come back with specific questions, answer them, then give them some sort of a few light, very light books and say, or a book, not a big thing, a little thing, and say to them, if you can develop 2 questions on that book, I'll give you some time. And then you've got a running chance that you're dealing with someone who really wants to know something. And then you have to be careful and gentle and slowly, slowly. Because karma ripens. If the karma is ripening for someone to learn about this, that's fine. If karma is ripening within this individual to learn to become an atheist, then that's karma ripening. If it's learning to become a Christian, that's karma ripening. And maybe for them at that time, that's the best thing. I don't know. The problem with converting, and His Holiness says this is a problem with people who convert. We want to tell everybody about it. how wonderful it is. Not a good idea. It must be a meeting of minds, not a kind of, have you heard the good news? Thank you, Megan. Thank you. Okay, before we finish, I'd like you to think about this. What is driving this death process? What drives the death process is exactly what's driving everything in our life, delusion and karma. Karma ripening, karma ripening, karma ripening. People think karma ripens and then there's a space. And then something good happens and there's another bit of karma. Then there's a space. Then another bit of karma. Not like that. Every moment of mind, develops karma. Because every moment of mind has attachment, aversion, and ignorance. So karma is like this. It's all over the place. 100 times faster than this, karma is developing and ripening. All at the same time. We learn it like this because it's the only way to learn it. Otherwise, too confusing. So what I'd like you to just think, you don't have to feedback on this. When someone says to you, ah, but that's karma. What are you thinking? Just consider, you don't have to feedback. Just what comes to your mind? Someone says to you, ah, yeah, but that's karma. When you hear that, what do you think? What are your thoughts? It's a word that people like. People like that word, karma. It's used in a variety of ways. I've seen it used as a bludgeon, like, well, that's just your karma, isn't it? Suck it up. Like that. So you start off with karma by understanding that karma, of all the topics in the Buddha Dharma, karma is the most difficult topic. Of all the topics that you'll study, nothing is more complicated than karma. It's even more complicated than an intellectual understanding of the nature of reality. Understanding the nature of reality, emptiness, is only one of the components needed to understand karma. When Geshe's are in Tibet, and even in India now, they were studying the Geshe program, which could be anything up to 15 years. One of the last topics to be taught is karma. In any depth, karma. Because you needed everything else in order to look at karma clearly. There are, within different Buddhist schools, some slight differences in the explanation of karma because there are differences in some schools understanding emptiness. Their understanding of emptiness is slightly different. And if their understanding of emptiness is slightly different, this bleeds through into understanding karma. It's not something to worry about, it's just something to be aware of. Another potential difficulty with the concept of karma is the early translations. It is said that a lot of the early translations there was a lack of precision, a real lack of precision when they were translating the karma. A lot of the words they used in the translation, especially in English, didn't mean the same as it did in the Sanskrit or even the Pali. What else makes karma difficult? Well, there are areas of karma which the Buddha did not teach. He was asked many types of questions on karma, and he didn't answer them. If you read the text, there's about 12 areas of questions that Buddha was asked, and he didn't answer. He didn't answer. It is said that he didn't answer because the question was framed with a lack of understanding. People weren't ready to ask the right question, so any answer that was given would not have been helpful. So you can say that only a Buddha fully understands karma. One of the reasons only a Buddha understands karma is only a Buddha really understands and has access to past and future lives. That doesn't mean to say you won't learn about karma, of course, but just be aware that vast areas about karma that were not answered. So the areas that were answered require a lot of study. And this is why when you get teachings on karma, both what I'm doing here, but even, you know, when you actually go deeper into this, then you need to have a good teacher. You know, be careful with teachers. Make sure it's a, you know, not just because they've no hair and wearing robes. Really investigate teachers, you know, investigate organizations really well so that when you get teachings about this, you're getting good stuff. Not a basic understanding and then with bells and whistles that somebody's imposed upon it. That's important. So relying on a teacher is good. The next thing to remember about karma is, remember when we talked about no creator God, things coming into being without chaos. It's not an accident. And I said that the closest thing we have to a creation principle is karma. It is our creation principle. So right now, could you maybe pick up this handout, the Turning the Wheel of Dharma handout? And look again at the second half, the bottom half of that. Does everyone have it? I've created these type of handouts so that if you did want to do further study, these are the headings that will be very useful to you. So looking again at the bottom half, you can see the section that says ignorance, afflictive emotion, karmic actions, true suffering. And remember I said, the karmic actions are like the wheels of the car. If you want to stop all this, take the wheels off the car. Your ignorance is